On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I think one of the most remarkable things about my guest, writer, director, operator, cinematographer, Cary Fukunaga, is that there's always a sense of movement in his films and rootlessness. We can go back to his film Sin Nombre, his great work on the first season of the HBO series True Detective, and his terrific new film adapted from the novel Beasts of No Nation, which is getting theatrical play, but also on Netflix. First of all, Cary, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Elvis.
And that sense of rootlessness in your movies, that sense of people looking for a place to land, in your, I shouldn't say your movies, but in your work, where does that come from for you?
I don't know. I mean, I lived a pretty itinerant childhood, and I wouldn't say a traumatically itinerant childhood, but I was always moving around. Like, by the time I was in high school, I didn't have friends from when I was in kindergarten. I was always jealous of those kids that had friends that long. But I kept moving in, even through college and in my 20s, and transplanting different countries and different cities, and trying to figure out how I was going to learn to make movies. And maybe that somehow has bled into the themes of my movies itself, but I haven't tried to analyze it too much.
Well, that's why we're here, so we can dig, peel back the layers of this. But certainly, and because I even feel it's more the case with the film of Beasts of No Nation than the novel, that sense of not having a place to be and looking for a place to settle. And I wondered, when you saw the novel, if that was one of the things that attracted you to it.
I think having brought about 5 years of research into sort of my experience of reading the novel.
Because the book came out 10 years ago now almost.
Yeah, basically. And I had started working on this in the late 90s actually as a subject.
Oh, really?
More so than honed in on story. But I think when I read the novel, I think movement had always been a part of what I wanted to do. Some of the ideas I'd been playing with before that were displaced people trying to make it across the bush, basically from the central eastern part of Sierra Leone to Freetown. Movement was always going to play a part in it. But what I think I saw in Uzo's novel was...
What you say is Uzo Dinwa-Iweala, whose novel was based on.
Yeah. Uzo for short. He just simplified the narrative in the sense...
It's almost like a piece of reporting the novel, actually.
Or even, it's more just like an interior monologue in the novel. You don't actually know what's happening. You don't know...
Or even where you are,
where
actually.
You are. You don't know what the aim of the battalion is. You don't know why and who they're killing, what tribe they're from. None of that is ever established in the novel. And we tried to maintain a certain amount of that in the film, but at a certain point, you have to ground it in something just because of the demands of physical production and your department heads needing something to base their artwork on. So costumes needed something to base on, production design needed something. And I just basically never named what country it is in, but anyone who knows the conflict in Sierra Leone will recognize a lot of the players.
Because I think it's fascinating, too, that sense we get from seeing it visualized, that sort of sumptuousness and fear. I mean, just having those two things coexist like that is really, to me, kind of compelling.
Well, even talking to Abraham, who played Agu, the harder scenes for him to play was actually not so much hard in terms of an emotional experience, but his having to walk through the jungle on his own in flip-flops and shorts. And if you take that to its basic level, he was afraid of snakes. He was afraid of walking through this field and potentially crossing paths with a
deadly snake.
Did you
know that when you were casting him? Did he tell you that?
No, but everyone's afraid of snakes there. I mean, they kill a snake on sight, whether it's deadly or not. And
you just don't know.
You just don't know. Well, I mean, you should know.
I mean, but it can happen so fast you don't know. So,
even in that location where we shot that scene, I'd almost stepped on a deadly snake. So I understand where that fear comes from. And we beat the bush pretty hard before we started shooting to make sure he was safe. But, you know, he was absolutely petrified of walking 100 yards through that bush, even though we kind of delineated where he should walk. So if you think about that same field is also a, just beyond it is a plantation. So at the same time, it's like it brings all this life. It's also a place that can take life, and it's all in the same place.
I should ask you, for people who don't know the movie, to tell them what the movie's about, Beasts of No Nation.
The movie and the novel are about a boy who is from a good family, a stable and loving family, and just happened to live in a town that's sort of in the middle of it's between two sides of a civil war. And eventually the war arrives to their doorstep and he loses his family. And he's forced to sort of run into the jungle on his own in the bush and is found by a battalion of irregular militia who are also participating in the war and at first offered protection, but then also taught how to kill and how to become part of that battalion. And the rest of the story really is about him not only trying to navigate the survival in this world, but also navigate his own moral descent.
I guess I was thinking about, I mean, I'm sure you've heard this a lot, but that idea that basically you kind of, I think both, but certainly in the movie, he's kind of carrying a narrative with him, and that narrative changes from place to place. And almost after a while, starts to feel like really what a Grimm's fairy tale is, that old idea of, I mean, for kids, the ultimate fear is losing your parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of starts like that. And then finding this other kind of parent who almost correlates to like a step-parent who's even more terrifying than the idea of having lost your parents.
Yeah, there is a probably in that old sort of folk-style sense, a feeling that if you misbehave, you'll be punished, right? So in some degrees, you could imagine his mischievousness in the beginning of the film, which is, you know, for comedic effect, but also for showing, you know, a bit of his character and his relationship with his brother and his parents. You know, internally, he could imagine his misbehavings could have led to him losing his family to some degree. And the rules that are established within the military battalion he ends up fighting with in terms of always obeying the commandant and doing what the commandant says, no matter what he asks for, if you disobey that, you could die.
It's the treatment we're talking about, the terrific new film, which is on Netflix and in theaters, Beasts of No Nation. It's writer, director, cinematographer. Is there anything else you didn't do on the film? Did you do catering on it as well,
Karen? I catered on Saturdays. I did these skewers every Saturday night. We did chicken and beef and pineapple.
And probably some leftover snakes. My guest is Cary Fukunaga. I think what I wonder so much about is for you is, did you, as a kid, watch a lot of documentaries? Because your movies kind of intersect for me, just Nombre and this, the line between documentary and fiction filmmaking?
I did watch some documentaries growing up. I feel like I'm from the Bay Area, from the East Bay, and independent cinema was definitely a part of my upbringing, as well as, you know, popcorn cinema. And I'm trying to think of the documentaries I saw growing up that might have affected me. I think more than anything, it was my love of history growing up. Outside of school or just reading about different periods of history and soaking in the details of these different times and worlds. And then when I went to college, I ended up studying history and political science. And
what history did you study?
Actually, it's more like historiography because my thesis was on two different museum exhibits at the Smithsonian. One was a More Perfect Union, which was the celebration of the bicentennial of the Constitution. And instead of celebrating it, they showed where it failed American citizens by interning Japanese American citizens. And it was a pretty controversial exhibition.
Pretty controversial.
Yeah, very controversial. And the same curators, about 6 years later, for the 50th anniversary of World War II, decided to explore the reason to use or not use the nuclear bomb or the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that exhibit was completely squashed by the veteran unions. And so my thesis was actually on what history is fit to tell the public. What are the public going to be able to understand? And how is that narrative controlled institutionally? So that does kind of, I think, bleed over into narrative filmmaking. And I think the freedom you get from telling fiction as opposed to nonfiction is to draw what you find to be the most compelling elements of the real world and, you know, re-edit them into something that's sort of a complete narrative.
Well, these narratives, though, between Sinombre and Beasts are kind of narratives that exist as kind of a counterpoint in the same way that More Perfect Union did, as a counterpoint to the official history.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that's your interest as well, you know, the story that's not being told almost, if you look in history terms, the story that are left to those who weren't the victors.
Right. I think what struck me, especially with Sin Nombre, coming from the Bay Area, coming from even, you know, my stepdad who was Mexican, my little brother's half Mexican, you know, being threatened as a child if I misbehaved to have to go work in the orchards, you know, to not know that narrative of the Central Americans crossing Mexico. That was complete news to me when I started doing my research. And that was sparked off of the incident that took place in Victoria, Texas in 2003 when a refrigerated trailer was abandoned there and several dozen immigrants died in it, including some children. And unfortunately, that history has been repeated again in Austria with the Middle Eastern immigrants.
Even as we speak, absolutely. Yes. But I mean, that history even precedes that in that movement of Central Americans through Mexico into the United States. It's just that became an incredibly well-publicized incident there. But I just found, again, I just think about how the camera is, you want to make us feel like participants and observers at the same time in the way that I think of as being a part of documentary filmmaking.
I remember, and this is much later than I think my sort of childhood in terms of taking in films, but the experience of watching a movie and what it can be. And there was a series of short films that were made about 9/11 in which Alejandro Iñárritu did one that was just a sound piece. And it's a very emotional sort of moment within all the short films. And I think short films are very, very difficult. As you can imagine, you spend a lot of years at Sundance watching short films and seeing what's out there. It's very difficult, I think, to do a good short film, probably harder than doing a good feature film, actually. And what he decided to do there instead was make it an experience. And I remembered when I was making Vittorio Parracino, my short film, I wanted to do a big section of it just all in darkness to make the audience, to transport them into that trailer and to feel what it's like on a more visceral level rather than just putting together the narrative and feeling it, you know, on that emotional level. And I think for me that's a key part in the experience of cinema and a key part why actually watching a movie in the theater is so much better than watching it at home, but to really immerse yourself and lose yourself in a story. And I think the space in which you experience it is a big part of that.
It's interesting because you're sort of connecting these movies and going back to that show as well. For you, the idea of these movies really taking place in the immediate present and that the history before we meet these people is immaterial because that's just exposition that can or may get in the way of the experience. You want to put this in what's going on with these people right away to make it that immediate, don't you?
I do, although my first acts tend to be a bit long. They're fat first acts because there is a certain amount of world building. It's not the same as, you know, science fiction world building, but you're bringing, for the most part, I think Sin Nombre and Beast is not geared towards people who come from a war-torn country or from Central America. It's geared to people who may not be, you know, familiar with the experience. And so there's a lot of introduction to that world happening, but it's not in a straightforward, let me spoon feed you the world exhibition.
But I think it's even more like trying to introduce us to a community rather than telling us who and what these people are and where they came from. You're sort of saying, here they are in this world in which they live. Mm-hmm. And then so it's like when they're separated from that world. I mean, for me, that's the feeling that you're out to communicate rather than just sort of offering classic exposition. And so it does take a little more time to set up that sense of community, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, because you have to know what you've lost. And that's the big part of, in Beasts at least, that first act that takes place with his home family actually isn't in the novel. The novel does visit the home family, does visit, talks about the sister, talks about his time with his mother and reading the Bible with his mother being some of his favorite moments. But I decided to add a couple new characters to make the family a larger, more chaotic place. And I do feel like family is, it's all about eating and being on top of each other and annoying each other and that love that comes out of even that dissatisfaction with having to be so close with each other. And I wanted to show that intimacy and that proximity and even the humor in that so that when that, even that tone of the beginning part of the movie is gone, as an audience member, you miss even the humor, the warmth of that.
Yeah, because it's in both of these, the family is such kind of an expansive place, and those kind of annoyances that you come to miss once they're gone. These families are broken up in such traumatic circumstances. I guess I wonder what your attraction is for that, too, that these are just such horrific circumstances in both situations, in both films.
I think part of it is just it's the reality, right? It's a reaction to the idea that families will always stay together, and it's you know, the safest, most unchanging element of human, of life, and that's just not true. There's even though we feel it's safest with family, it is the most vulnerable, I think, to be broken up for economic reasons, for conflict reasons, for any number of reasons that a family can be broken up. And it's about all of us, once that happens to us, how we try to reconstruct that safe place again.
We'll take a break. My guest is director, writer, cinematographer Cary Fukunaga's new film, which is on Netflix and at theaters near you, is Beasts of No Nation. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW, only at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm sitting across from the ambitious and multi-talented Cary Fukunaga, whose new film on Netflix is Beasts of No Nation. I do like that idea, though, that the idea that family is such an important and vulnerable thing. And even in True Detective, it's that as well, that idea of needing family and the ache when it starts to recede into the distance. We're always aware of that it's very slowly going away. It's almost like looking at being in the backseat of a car and looking out that rear window.
It is, and that's for Martin Hart's character, the arrogance, I think, of feeling like he had created what he was supposed to create out of a perfect family, but didn't honor what a family needs in order to survive.
And it creates almost kind of immediate nostalgia. I mean, like the very next day when these things end, people miss them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the wounds never really get a chance to close. And just that, again, what we were talking about in the first half, that idea of being pulled away from these things that define you.
Yeah, I guess it's in the Freudian sense, we'll never be as safe as we were in the womb. We're always trying to find a way to get back in.
Well, but even being pulled out of the house, I mean, it's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is that thing, that those walls and how safe it is to be inside versus the dangers of outside for you. I mean, the exteriors in your work is truly, it's the scariest thing you can imagine. These are de facto horror movies in some way.
I mean, the unknown is the great adventure for everything. I mean, even you think of in micro steps, you know, your first sleepovers as a child, you know, just the smell of a friend's house and how foreign it was and alien it was and how much sometimes you just wanted to go home in the middle of the night and just smell the smell of your sheets, you know, to, you know, go much further than that. You know, you have the adventurers who cross oceans or people who climb mountains or now reaching out into space and Mars. You know, there's a part of us that has to learn how to leave that home nest, or sometimes we're ripped from it. And it's probably in varying degrees the most traumatic part of our existence as human beings is that treading out into the unknown.
But so much about movies is people, characters who have a hunger for that sense of adventure, who want to leave where they're from and try new things. And the idea of it being your own choice is what your work is, what you're attracted to as a dramatist. Mm-hmm. Having that choice taken away from you, being forced out of this thing that is what you want and being forced to go on adventures.
Yeah. I think the challenge with a movie like Beast actually is that, you know, you want your character to make decisions. And when you're forcing that, the decisions then fall into the element of survival. But for child soldiers, they don't often have much options in terms of choice. The agency has been stripped away and they're being controlled. So part of it is, how do you define a character once they're sort of under such complete control like that?
There's kind of a, certainly in this case here with Idris Elba, who is, again, a welcoming and completely terrifying new parental figure, that kind of idea of trying to find something to imprint, to lock onto, and just wanting. There's something so primal about him wanting to find this new father figure and being embraced and punished simultaneously.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he wants. He looks at the Commandant Idris's character as a potential new protector, as a potential new example to follow,
yeah, sure.
You know. And you know, he had his older brother before, he had his father before, and now he's got these soldiers and these, you know, they're taking drugs and doing terribly violent things. And you have a leader who's taking advantage of all these people on multiple levels.
I guess I think, too, so often of your work, you tend to cast people for their eyes, don't you? I mean, the way that we can sort of read their eyes, because there are so many instances in your film where they're not speaking. Mm-hmm. And we have to see in expressive terms what it is that's going on with them.
Yeah, that is the key, actually, in casting. And I remember telling my casting directors just that, actually, about the eyes for Sin Nombre, you know, because they kept kind of sending me these sort of middle-class kids who were going to try and act like gang members. And, you know, I certainly did not grow up in gangs, but I know what street looks like in terms of, you know, the intelligence and the sort of the calculating that takes, you know, place when people are watching and observing other people and seeing what's the what in any given situation. That alertness, I suppose. And that goes the same thing for soldiers, you know, unless they're, you know, in some way self-medicated. There is something in the eyes that's going on that's a computer that's working very fast, you know. And in casting, you know, trying to find an Agu, that was exactly what I was looking for. Because, again, the novel is so internal. And trying to find someone who expresses on the outside what seems to express a very active internal life was sort of key.
And how many young actors did you go through before you found Abraham Atta?
Harrison Nesbitt, the casting director, told me recently it was 2,500 kids. I don't remember that many, but, you know, I must have seen a couple hundred. And then out of those, we chose about 30 to take part in this sort of intensive theater workshop we did with another friend of mine, Zoe Martinson, who was acted as the acting coach. And she had done a theater workshop in Ghana before and had worked with many kids and had a sense of how to sort of equip these kids with the basic tools they needed to act on camera.
Because I think in a case like this, you've got to feel in the same way you do in Sin Nombre. You've got to feel that people are reacting what's going on around them as much as they are to other people. And so you can even get out of kids who are actors who even accomplish is they know how to react to another person. Mm-hmm. When you turn them away from that person, they've got to react to the world. It becomes a different thing.
That was a lot of our exercises, actually. It was sort of like Meisner technique, living in the moment, repetition, not getting lost in the words of the screenplay just yet, but learning to feel comfortable and act like yourself in any given scenario. And if we threw in sort of any sort of, you know, zingers to them, they could just react to it immediately and go with it and never stop acting. That was a big thing, is like, no matter what happens, don't stop being in character. Always stay in character. Don't look at the camera. Always stay in character.
How long did it take you to get him to that point?
Well, he learned pretty quick. All of them did, actually. And I would say about halfway through production, it was a 7-week-long production.
That's it?
Yeah, a war film with kids in 7 weeks.
You must sleep too much.
Yeah, I'm definitely, I owe some sleep debt. But it was like Bowfinger. You know, he gained a sort of a knowledge, all the kids did, about how a set works and who did what. That was, you know, it was like a master's class in making a movie. And we'd talk about the setups for a shot out, you know, walking through it before we did it. And he'd say, so the camera's going here. And he'd do that little thing with his fingers, sort of like mimic where the lens is. And I'm like, yeah, Abraham, the camera's going to be there. And he's like, and then here, and then on himself. You know, he knew what was going to happen. He knew when his close-up was happening. And he also really started to invest in it. Like, he wanted to do a good job. He didn't want to just get through the day. And he wanted to make me happy. And in the same way that, you know, some of these kids would want to make their commander happy. And they would all look at me when we stopped. And I'm sitting there scratching my head trying to figure out, you know, do we have it? Do we have to move on? We probably have to move on, but I kind of want to get one more take, you know. But they were watching. They knew.
It's the treatment, my guest, who's the first person to ever reference Bowfinger in a positive way on this show, is Cary Fukunaga. His new film, which is on Netflix, is Beasts of No Nation. But I guess what strikes me so often about your work, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, is the difference between daytime and nighttime in your movies. Mm-hmm. There's a real character difference in the movies when the sun goes down. And is that something for you that comes out of seeing films, or is it something that's a real-world thing that you want to get across?
It's funny you say that, just technically speaking. I'm always fascinated with how to treat nighttime on camera. You know, you've seen the style of treating night change over the years from, you know, whether it's interior studio nighttime exteriors, you know, in classic Hollywood, or the day for night of the 60s and 70s with the Westerns and whatnot, and to the giant sort of blue, you know, stadium lighting, you know, from the 80s and 90s. And then now there's like a, there's all kinds of different ways to treat nighttime. I've actually done a lot of day for night in my movies just because I think it's the closest to mimicking what I've seen with bright moonlight. But when we don't have the luxury of being able to use daylight for nighttime scenes and we actually have to shoot at nighttime, it's really just about finding something that, that mimics reality. And that's partially because what I've done up till now has been mainly some version of realism. I haven't done a film that's really tonally different from reality. So that's still kind of where I'm basing everything on, you know, how I see the world.
I'm thinking about the thing that I'm sure everybody's brought up to, that incredible shootout in True Detective that's all nighttime. It takes us from being in street lights to interiors, so being away from all those lights, and you just get the sense of what the night sky is like mm-hmm. when there's not much light in it. And it's because it's not in a big city, it's a different scheme. So that idea of not knowing where to turn, for me, that's where that's almost as primal as a horror film. And that's why I use the word primal, because there's a primal feel to the night that you shoot. And I just was wondering if there was a specific source, or you're trying to create this thing you're talking about that feels like a night that's organic to the material that you're doing.
Yeah, I think it's mainly based in the realism of the material, though, the organic sort of like development of wherever this is taking place, this is the way it should look like. But the fear of what's out there, what you can't see, is definitely, I would say, more in the framing, actually, in a lot of ways. You know, whether we choose to look outside or not, like in Detective, in the long sequence, you know, we look out the window once only. And in the screenplay, it would cut outside all the time. It would cut outside to explain how the mob's growing up. It would cut outside to say when the cops are coming. It would cut outside for these different things. Once I decided I was doing a one-er, I knew I couldn't do that.
You mean a single take?
The single take. How do you communicate these developments that are happening? And that's through sound, or also just through the people inside reacting to something outside, even if we can't see what it is.
That's part of it too. That idea, what you can't see at night, takes on this whole kind of psychological import that doesn't exist in the daytime. Even though you still can't see outside during the day.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I'm afraid of the dark.
Are you really?
Yeah. I mean, like, I still get spooked if I'm like, if I'm gonna go upstairs in a house or something in the middle of nowhere, and I'm turning out the lights downstairs, and you know, when that moment when you're on the stairs and the darkness is at your heels, I might jog up those stairs a little faster.
Are there horror films you saw as a kid or something? Because this idea of bringing horror into real-life situations is the thing that links, even your short, a lot of stuff I've seen that you've done, that idea of the real world, the quotidian horror, as a matter of fact, is integral to the way you think.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say quotidian or even banal, I think, is far more interesting than the sort of hyped-up moments. You know, it is... again, basing on reality, some of the most terrible acts of violence that I researched, whether it was amongst the gangs or even in war, they come and they go in an instant, an everyday moment, you know, whether it's like you think of Sarajevo and you're in a market and a mortar just comes and lands on you in the middle of buying vegetables for dinner. You're doing the most basic thing and life snatched away. And that's horrifying. You're in Aleppo and you're sleeping in your family and your neighborhood gets, you know, gassed. It's just the most basic thing, you know, your family's in their pajamas and that's just how you go out. It's horrifying. And you don't have to amplify life to see how vulnerable and how precious and how delicate it is.
And that idea, though, for me, too, the being taken out of the mainstream gaze. I mean, the worlds of Beasts of No Nation and Sinombre exist outside the white world, really. And that's for me, that becomes a kind of a welcoming thing in these movies. But it's also so much about the powerlessness that exists for you, a kind of lack of impact on your world that's a part of the way you live every day. And that interests you too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's not that I don't think that in my own sort of domestic, and I'm saying domestic in terms of the United States, experience, that there doesn't exist the equivalent of these kinds of conflicts and dramas. It's just more of my interests just tend to lie, and I've always looked out into the world, even as a kid, and been really curious about knowing what's out there. And I think that what I have learned in the sort of various trips and travels that I've done is that most people, no matter what the cultural differences are essentially the same. And that's what I just like to sort of highlight every time I make a story. It's to strip away the exoticism.
Because I just find myself thinking in True Detective that these two guys are being interrogated by people of color. And there is a presumption of power that they have. And these detectives who are asking them questions are sort of incredulous at their entitlement.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was a specific choice. I was just, I think at the time, reading the screenplays and thinking we needed much more diversity on here. I, of course, didn't want the two detectives to be the least capable ones. But the scripts weren't completely finished yet when we were casting that. Yeah, the race part of it, I don't know. Like, what I did like about Beast of the Nation, for example, is that there wasn't a white savior.
Yeah, it's not Blood Diamond, which is a similar story.
Right.
Going back to the late 80s, early 90s, where it had to be Kevin Kline or Marlon Brando letting us know how hard it was for these people.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's what I meant about saying that's what I think really connects Beasts of No Nation and Sinombre, that there's not that person mm-hmm. who's telling us what we're supposed to feel.
Right. And I think that might be the surprise for people who don't typically go and see these films is that connection that's built almost without knowing it to these characters, without needing a cultural ambassador to make you feel comfortable, you know. That might be what's surprising to viewers who see these films, especially – you know, if you think of more conservative viewers who are going to watch Beast of No Nation just based on, you know, recommendations from friends or whatever now, to not need, you know, the white savior to bring them in there.
Or to even just explain why they're there in the first place.
Right.
I mean, that idea of the movies basically getting the nod of respectability by having that person in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, again, for me, it's even, I don't know how conscious it was, but it exists in those interrogation scenes in True Detective where suddenly power shifted in a very subtle way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose it's a good thing.
As you look at me, I would not, yes, it's a good thing. We're out of time. Carrie, thanks so much for doing this.
All right, thank you for having me, Ellis.
My pleasure. My guest is Carrie Fukunaga's new piece you can see on Netflix, Beast of No Nation. Please see Sinombre. It's a terrific film which deserves a lot more attention. A recording engineer who also mixes the show is Kat Yoris, edited by Blake Veit, who's the associate producer. We're going to leave the light on for you. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.